Welcome to Innovator Insights from Idea to Impact. I am your host, Henrik Johansson. I am the CEO and one of the founders of Gemba. Gemba helps entrepreneurs and companies to turn their great ideas into awesome new consumer products. Please stay to the end of the podcast and you'll learn how you can be our next guest on Innovator Insights from Idea to Impact. Let's do it. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Innovator Insights from Idea to Impact. This is the podcast where we interview successful entrepreneurs that have started with an idea and taken it all the way to finished product and impact or a service. Most of the founders we talk to on this podcast are, you know, consumer product entrepreneurs. But as you know, from time to time, we invite other folks that we think could have a great perspective. And today we're talking to one of them. We are excited to have Rolf Biernath with us. He is the founder and CEO of Biernath Consulting. And prior to that, he spent 30 plus years at 3M, and he's the author of many, many patents, and he's an expert in B2B product development. So without further ado, welcome to the podcast, Rolf.
Thanks, Henrik.
Yeah, Rolf and I had an opportunity to talk a week back or so, and it was more to explore a partnership, but once I learned more about Rolf's approach to product development, there were so many interesting overlaps between B2B and B2C, and I think there's a lot we can learn from each other, and our listeners can learn from Rolf's perspective. So excited to have you here. Thank you. But before we jump into it, can you give our listeners a little bit about yourself, your background, where you live, what do you do when you're not working?
Sure. I'm a happy grandfather right now. I early retired from 3M at 60 so that I would have enough energy in my life to start a consulting business. And my goal in consulting is to help 10 companies each develop a new product line. And I'm giving myself a timeline of about 10 years. And so that's really my goal. As you said, I really do kind of focus on B2B. So yeah. I'm B2C is a little fickle for me. B2B is nicer because if you talk to your customer, they can frequently tell you what they need and what would make the sale, what would make them switch what they're doing to what you can produce for them.
Yeah, that's a luxury that you often don't have in B2C. And let's get into it. Before that, you're in the Minneapolis area, is that right?
Yeah, north of Minneapolis in the country here. Gets down to minus 30, minus 40 some winters, and up to 105 in the summers. So we see quite a range of temperatures here.
Yeah. And before that, you were at UCLA and Georgia Tech, got a double degree.
UC Berkeley. Berkeley, where the weather's always 70 degrees and sunny. and then Atlanta, Georgia is where I grew up. Went to Georgia Tech there.
Yeah. So before we jump into Biernath Consulting and the B2B side, can you give us a little bit of an overview of you as a, you have so many patents. Can you talk a little bit about your experience prior to Biernath Consulting?
Yeah. I spent 30 years at 3M. Developing new products over a range of industries, everything from adhesives, which you might expect at 3M, through to novel displays that you can read outdoors. We were working on a kiosk once for a very large outdoor theme park company for making outdoor viewable displays that were low energy. But gave you video speeds and stuff. Worked on a license plate system. I'll show you one. it's fun because this is one I like. It's a patents.
Yeah, so, funny names. For our listeners that aren't watching on YouTube, this is like a drawing of an optically active materials and articles and system in which they may be used. So that's one of your patents?
Yeah. And that, what it really is it's a way of embedding QR codes in reflective signage.
Oh, wow.
So And if you look on the right image, that's what you see to your visible eye.
Mm-hmm.
And to the digital camera, looking in the near infrared, they see the QR code on the left.
Interesting.
And it's a very high contrast system for the machine.
Yeah.
But it doesn't bother the person. So it's one of the ones that they like. I won't go into them, but
yeah.
I did some work on micro replication as well, which was mm-hmm. really cool. And that ended up being used a lot in the COVID test kits and stuff.
Yeah. That's awesome. So generally, I mean, 3M, I think, is a company everybody thinks about when you talk about innovation and new products. And being there for 30 years must have been, you know, an innovative company for 30 years. Can you say anything about the speed of innovation or how innovation has changed over three decades?
Yeah. It,
or maybe it hasn't.
It hasn't. It hasn't. Yeah. What's interesting is I spent a lot of my career working on what we call the front end of innovation.
Mm-hmm.
So it was new products for new markets. And that's kind of the riskiest area you can be in. You know, if you work on adjacent products for adjacent markets, that's low risk. But you get out to this new products for new markets space, and that really is a stretch. Most, so your hit rate is lower.
But the most fun, right?
it's a lot of fun. Innovation. Yes, I agree. And that turns out to be where a lot of startups operate.
Yeah.
They're working on a new product for a new market. Intrinsically, because they don't have any product in the market yet. So by definition, that's where they're at. And we at 3M, I can't say overall as an average for the company or anything, but my career hit about a 10% hit rate, which is consistent with startup hit, you know, success rates. 90% of startups, 90% of new product ideas don't hit market expectations. And
yeah, it's a sobering stat.
It's a very sobering stat. You know, that your odds are 90% that you're not going to succeed. It's you got to really believe in your idea. And I reflected on that career over the last, I looked at like 50 different product development programs that I was part of. And I reflected on those, asked myself, what about those succeeded? Why did they fail? What were the reasons they failed? And what were the questions we should have asked much sooner in the development effort than we did? Sometimes you find one question that kills the program.
Yeah.
And it's a fatal flaw, you know, and I've developed a screening method. I call it build what wins, so that you focus your efforts on building what wins instead of building what can't win. And I take people through a screen looking at viability. Is the problem important enough to your customer that they're going to eagerly pay you some money to solve it for them?
Yeah.
Defensibility. If you create this new market, this new product for this new market, can you keep in control of your profit share? And then the third one is feasibility, which is where everybody likes to focus on, because that's the fun part. That's the fun part, making the product, building it, testing it, making sure you can scale it profitably. And then the fourth one is timing. And timing sits on top of the other ones. Viability, like, does the customer want it now? Do they know they need it now? Are you going to have to educate the market? A lot of companies don't have time to educate their market.
Yeah.
They need to find, they want to come up with, you know, things that people can need now. Defensibility, patents are only good for 20 years. So can you extract enough profitability with your defense strategies that you have? And there's a lot more than just patents, but that's the key one. And then feasibility, can you make it with existing technologies that you got available now?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's great framework. And for the listeners, you know, mostly we talk B2C, consumer products. Can you give us a sort of range or the type of B2B businesses that you work with and the type of products?
Yeah, some of them become consumer adjacent. Mm-hmm. You know, they're sold through and then to another customer. I've got one company, they make like humidity products for cigars and musical instruments and stuff like that. So their ultimate market is consumer as well, but they've also got an arm that does more B2B sales as well.
That's great. So let's go in a little more into the methodology that you use. You know, on the B2C side, we do more and more for our customers. I think the correlation, what you're talking about, we call it market validation, where we take a consumer product and before the customer invests all his money in designing it and engineering it and sampling and prototyping and making it, you got to try to figure out if there's a market, right? And the way you can do that in consumer space, it's a lot easier now than it used to be, but you can create very photorealistic images. You can test different branding, different packaging, different pricing before you even make the product, right? And then we often run a set of campaigns on Facebook and other platforms to see, you know, or at least get a good estimate of how much are you going to have to spend in advertising for someone to actually come and make a purchase decision. And through that, you can get a pretty good picture of, is this a project worth pursuing in its current state or current design? Or do we need to cut costs? Or do we need to, you know, change something else about the product? Do we need to change the market? Can you talk about how you do that for the B2B companies?
Yeah, that's where things are different. Frequently with a B2B customer, they're looking for either cost savings over what their workaround that they've got for the problem right now. Mm-hmm. You can talk to them and figure out how much it's costing them right now to solve the problem the way they're currently solving it. That sets essentially the upper bound of what you can sell your product for. So anyway, that sets the upper bound of the product. Feasibility sets the lower bound, like how much can you make it for and everything. And then your margins, what's in between, right? You know, where's the happy medium of good margin where your customer feels like they're getting a good deal, you're getting a good deal, it's sustainable for both of you, and you're both benefiting from the sale. Mm-hmm. But you can actually talk to the customer and they can frequently tell you, this is what we need. This is what our headaches are. Mm-hmm. If you could give us, 20% savings and the same performance or give us performance right now. We've got this workaround. It's taken us, three steps in our manufacturing process. If you can cut it down to one, like you say you can, that would be, very valuable to us because it would save us labor time. It would save us, it would improve our quality because now we've only got one step we can fail on instead of three. Mm-hmm. So.
That makes sense. Another thing you told me about that I found really fascinating is how to prioritize, right? Because, in the consumer business and particularly as we work with mostly smaller, mid-sized companies, often it's the very first product for this brand or under this brand, or maybe second, third product, but it's not like they have a ton of different options. Usually they come to us, they're pretty determined that this is the product I'm making, help me make this product. Sometimes we consult with bigger companies and look at whole collections, but that's the predominant use case. And can you contrast that to B2B where I think you said that often they have a whole slew of product ideas. How do you pick which one to work on next?
Yeah, pretty much any product company, B2B or B2C, I think, that's been around for more than 5 years has more product ideas than they've got bandwidth to work on. Yeah. And it's interesting what can happen there is that you can slowly get 10 different ideas that are kind of gurgling around that come up at different meetings. And like the CEO has one idea, the CMO has another idea, the head of engineering has a third idea, and the sales director has a fourth, right? Yeah. And the poor CEO or president of the company is sitting there playing referee between all these ideas instead of in between all these people. Mm-hmm. And frequently, and this happens way more than people admit, they'll sit on all those ideas for too long. I heard of fast food chain that wanted to do some innovation in their drive-thru. Mm-hmm. And they sat on the idea that they had for 2 years because they couldn't come to agreement in the executive group on how to implement it and what to do about it. And it had become a game of politics.
Yeah. So it's people start digging in or, you know, there's, like you said, politics, there's personal priorities or, you know, agendas maybe that, you know, why you want your idea to win. So how do you deal with that?
I work on an evidence-based prioritization system that gets the opinions out, gives people opportunity to express their opinions, but the definitions, like I rate things like 1 to 5, and we go even in half steps, so 1.5, 2, 2.5. But for some to have a 5, it's got supporting data, it's got modeling results, it's got, you know, we've built this before and it's a small tweak to our current product. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the sort of thing that can get a 5. Potentially things that can get a 5, and I have like 12 different rating, 12 different criteria that we look at that span, like what I said, viability, defensibility, feasibility, and timing.
Yeah.
And what I do that's unique is have a clear definition of what a 4 means, for example, what a 5 means. I also collect for each of those ratings an evidence rating for it. That's also 1 to 5. Five is, in this case, I was conflating them before. Sorry about that. But 5 in this case is we've got all the people we need to build this product. We've got all the equipment we need already to build this product. We've got the bandwidth in the company to be able to add this product to our product line.
Yeah.
We've got cost modeling that's been done. We've got letters of intent from our customers that say if we can meet these specifications, they will buy this much from us each year. Those are very quantitative and tangible things that can be brought up.
Yeah.
And it kind of gets the politics out of things.
Yeah, I can imagine. So you bring this framework into the organization, they document their existing competing ideas using your framework, I presume, and then there's some prioritization after that. Then how does that usually go?
It actually goes pretty interesting. Like I had one company we just did it with, and it went from 8 ideas that they had down to, we got a clear top 3. And so they can like check out on 5 of them. So 5 of 5 projects that had been consuming small amounts of bandwidth of people's brain, right? You know, your brain gets fractioned based on, you've got your pet idea, you're for that. So we're putting 5 of them into park. And what that means is, it doesn't mean they're dead. It just means we'll look at them again in 6 months. We'll reassess. We know what needs to change on each of those for them to become contenders.
Got it. So it might be that this one sounds promising, but there's not enough evidence, so we need to go talk to customer or something like that.
Yes, yes. And so the engineer that whose pet idea that is, can go and actually collect some real data to support their idea.
Yeah.
They know, okay, I've got to go call a couple customers or, you know, which means I got to buddy up with some friends in sales and get out there to meet the customers. But it gives them something real to do and something evidence-based to come back with. And that compares in a lot of companies to just trying to, persuade your boss into voting higher on your idea, where a lot of prioritization is just opinions.
Yeah.
And I try to get that out of it.
Yeah. I know in past tech companies, there's often something called the product council inside the organization that, you know, establishes this kind of process that you're talking about. So I think that's super important that it's not just a one-time thing, but it's a recurring theme. And it's something that everybody knows. This is what we do every 6 months. And then we prioritize and then we, you know, vet the different ideas. So I think that's super healthy. Yeah. So my question was like, do you establish that kind of product council? I assume that you need ultimately, you know, the CEO is the decision maker, right? But do you have a framework for how they should make the decisions?
I don't tell them what decision to make, but I do because it's their business, right? Yeah. And all product development has a certain degree of risk to it, regardless. You know, we can do our sprints and test out the ideas and everything looks very promising, but there's still all sorts of things that can happen in the time between having the idea and getting it out to market. So there's nothing about this guarantees success, but what it does is it also uncovers products who are guaranteed to be unsuccessful. Sometimes the product can be guaranteed to be unsuccessful because it's just too complex for the customer to use, or it's, I'm just trying to think of some, it turns out you're bumping up against some major competitor's patents. And you don't have a good workaround around those patents. Your idea actually depends on your competitor's patents. That's basically a don't go there. It's a pivot is what we get to if we have that kind of finding. Because it says, okay, we got to find a better way to do it than even what our competitor is doing.
Yeah, that makes sense. You use something called build what wins. Is that something separate from this or is this part of the same framework?
That's the build what wins is the whole framework. And then the pressure test sprint is a 2-week sprint where we take the best ideas, generally the top idea, and run that through a battery of questions. It's the same battery of questions that I found killed different programs over the years at 3M, as well as elsewhere. I've been interviewing CEOs and product leaders at different companies for the book. And I've actually added a couple more questions based on some of the failure modes they've revealed. For example, just the other day I was talking with a CEO and he said, we just had to come up with something because we knew our competitor was making an announcement at this big trade show and we had to have a counterpunch. So that's what launched our last program. It was just a purely reactive play.
That doesn't sound like a great strategy.
But and he agreed with that wasn't a great strategy, but it was, that's sometimes the frame of mind people have sometimes.
That makes total sense. Great. Let's see. And what are you focused on right now? What makes you excited about it? You've been doing this BNF for close to 10 years, right? Some of it.
Yeah.
3M. What's your focus for 2026 and ahead?
Focus for 2026 is I'm working on the book. I really want to get this out in front of people. I think it's real compatible. There's a lot of discipline people take into coming up with product ideas. you know, brainstorming sessions, design sprints, all sorts of cool things in disciplines that there are for developing, for instantiating new product ideas. And then there's a great process, you know, stage gates and everything for developing products in companies. So people are very rigorous about their development process. But where the gap is right now that I think I've found a workable solution for, it's not 100%, as I say, because everything's involves some judgment call at the end of the day. But the Build What Wins method gives leadership real evidence and real data from which to make a decision. So that they go in knowing what, you know, eyes wide open, what the risks are in this project and what the potential benefits are from if we're successful at developing this product. So it's really designed just to give people evidence and clarity around their decision. And then because it's well documented and the data is open to the team, everybody on the team generally agrees with the decision. There doesn't get to be this, oh, but they didn't consider this. You know, so you get team alignment, especially among the leadership team.
I love that. You know, I can see the the difference from, you know, bringing in a McKinsey consultant or someone like that, that gives you the answer. It's almost like you're coming in, you're actually giving them the methodology for how to find the answer themselves, which is something, you know, it's the whole analogy of give somebody a fish or teach them how to fish. And it sounds like you're teaching these organizations how to fish.
Teaching them how to fish. And the size companies I deal with, like the 5 to 50 million in revenue companies, they frequently, if they have an innovation group, it's a very small innovation group. Typically, their innovation group is 20% of this engineer and 20% of that engineer. And innovation goes very slowly as a consequence. I come in, I actually get in there and I've got the technical background. I can come into these companies, understand their technologies, and come alongside their people. And like now with one company I'm talking to, he's saying that in 2 weeks, I'll be able to help them accomplish what would take them basically 6 months of their fractionated time to get to. And I do most of the work for them. That's kind of the cool thing. I love learning. So this feeds my passion for learning. And I love new products. And I love to help people figure out how to build what wins.
That's awesome. Sounds like a really valuable service, and that you find a great niche there. And personally, I've learned a lot too, that my head is spinning of, you know, how do we bring some of these methodologies into what Gemba does. If people want to learn more, where can they find you, and where can they find your, you know, your writing or your,
I write on LinkedIn. I write on LinkedIn on, it's the Build What Wins Fast Clarity newsletter. And they can find me actually on buildwhatwins.com.
Oh, great.
And if they want to email me, it's rolf@buildwhatwins.com.
Rolf, R-O-L-F, right?
You got it.
Awesome. so we're kind of coming up on time here. Before we wrap, I always ask for, you know, one piece of advice or something that you would want to share with our listeners, keeping in mind that a lot of them are early in, you know, maybe not their career, but in often in their product creation career. And, you know, many are professionals that started the first consumer product company And some, of course, are more experienced and have done it for years. But any piece of advice you'd share with them?
I recommend three books right now. Great. One is a book I wrote a chapter in, so I've actually got that behind me there. It's got this really abstruse title, but it's basically an AI playbook and workbook. Mm-hmm. It's got prompts. We got GPTs for each chapter. And it'll take people through the ideation of a product idea, mm-hmm. all the way through the different steps, brainstorming different solutions for it, and talking to customers and simulating a lot of the interactions with AI.
That's great.
Then there's two other books.
One so before book, you, okay, for sure. People are just listening, what was the name of the first book?
Oh, The Generative Organization.
The Generative Organization. And who's the author?
Brian Cassidy, me, and 34 other AI experts.
Okay, great.
So, yeah.
And what was the second one?
Yeah, and the second one here is called The Right It. I've actually met Alberto Savoia. And The Right It. And this is very consumer products oriented.
Okay.
It works for B2B as well in some moderate context. And then the third book is The Mom Test.
The Mom Test.
This is how to talk to your customers so that they're not just telling you you got a great idea.
Awesome. So, and author for that one?
Author of that one's Rob Fitzpatrick.
Ron Fitzpatrick. Okay. Those are great recommendations. Really, really appreciate that. I'm a big reader. You see some of my bookshelves. Those are just the top 10%. But like you, I love learning and committed to it. And, you know, it's a lifelong quest.
Yeah, it's fun. And the other thing I've found, just to kind of close up here, is idea people don't mind you telling them they've got a bad idea.
Hmm, interesting.
Because they're confident that they'll come up with a better solution or a better idea.
Mm-hmm.
And really, nobody wants to waste 2 years developing a product that ultimately fails.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. I spent too many years over my career doing that exact scenario, having fun doing it until the very end where we realized, this isn't going anywhere. And so I created basically the tool set that I wish I'd had in my career.
Yeah.
And the nice thing with AI now is the questions we got, it would have taken like 6 months to answer those questions, like a team of six people, 6 months to answer those questions, even 5 years ago.
Yeah.
But now with AI and deep research capabilities, the synthetic personas you can develop with AI, you can do a lot of this research in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Two people, 2 weeks. I partner up with their chief product guy and we crunched through it in 2 weeks, and it's amazing what we learn. So
that's awesome. So circling back to where we started, you mentioned that you see probably a 10% success rate, 90% failure rate. Do you have evidence, or what are you able to move that needle, having a higher success rate through this methodology?
I'm still too early to say, but I welcome the question. It's something I'm tracking.
Yeah. Same here at Gemba. You know, we, similar to you, we, in the beginning, we took on all types of projects, trying to grow as quickly as possible. And then we realized that there's certain customers that really shouldn't start this journey because they're not, either the idea isn't validated, that they don't have the funding, they're not prepared for take the whole journey through. And, you know, that's the last thing you want to see, someone wasting their hard-earned savings on a project that ends halfway through. So, we share that goal to try to make sure that you help people and develop the right products to have long-term success.
Yeah, very much so. That's why we're here. Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Well, Rolf, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to join the podcast. I look forward to staying in touch and comparing notes over the years ahead. Thank you. Have a great rest of your summer.
Thank you. You too. All right.
All righty. This is Henrik Johansson again. Thank you so much for listening to Innovator Insights from Idea to Impact. If you are a successful product entrepreneur or you work in a company that creates new products and you have an interesting story about how you developed your product and brought it to market and you would like to be on this podcast, please go to Gemba.com and click on podcast and you can fill out an application to be on the podcast. We'd love to hear from you. If you liked this podcast, you enjoyed this interview, and we would greatly appreciate if you would share it on social media. You can just do a quick screenshot with your phone and text it to a friend or post it on socials. If you know anyone that you think would be a great guest, please tag them on social media and let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovator Insights. And would love to see your posts and any suggestions you have to guests. That's how we find most of our guests, from suggestion from other listeners. We're regularly putting out new episodes and new content to make sure you don't miss any episode. Please go ahead and subscribe. Your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show and it means a ton to me and the team. We really appreciate it. Do you want to know more about Gemba, me, or the podcast? Please go to Gemba.com and click on podcast, or you can follow me on LinkedIn. That's where I do most of my posts. Again, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time. Have a great day.